Just want to cover, I have some topics I'd like to cover and then answer questions. People have been handing me, you know, things from yesterday's class. Maybe we can try to get to some of them. But the topic I wanted to address today is, if we say what get an idea what this Varnashram Dharma means, and if we accept it as a goal, then one of the big problems is what do we do to get there from here? Because one thing is, it was clear to me that, you know, to have a real Varnashram system, you need an agrarian economy, and here we are in the middle of an industrial society. And even if we have some farm communities here and there for preaching and everything, we're still going to be in the middle of an industrial society. And we're going to be making devotees, recruiting them out of industrial societies, and they won't be trained for a Varnashram society. So this is how to get there from here. And I have several suggestions which I'd like to mention. Prabhupada kept talking about ISKCON as a brahminical institution. I've come to give you a brain. So many times he says this is the function that he particularly for society wanted ISKCON to do. And on this matter, I believe that one of the first steps and something that's starting is we have to see ISKCON, that is to say the temples and associated institutions, and even some of the communities around temples, as primarily educational institutions. There is an order of Prabhupada's that he gave, and which was an order that his disciples were, for whatever reasons, unable to follow. And it was one he talked about quite a bit and which he laid great importance on. And still, just when it came to doing it, everybody kind of, I don't know, just didn't have what it took. And this order is that there should be a system of education in ISKCON with the degree program of Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Vedanta, and Bhakti Sarvabhauma. So here you have one great, big, fat, implemented order for a long time. And the fact that we are didn't implement it, I think, was related to Prabhupada's criticism. You think my books are just for distributing and not for studying. I think if we actually implement that order and think of ISKCON as an educational institution, especially the temples, as places of, Patana Patana. Right? One studies the Vedas and teaches it to others. And therefore, primarily as brahminical, that will be a very big start. From that, so many other things will be clear. See, sometimes if you don't take step one, then step two and step three are not clear. But immediately you take step one, then the next step gets illuminated, then you take that step, then the next step gets illuminated. So if we can't see very far in the direction, it may be that certain things we have to do first, then we'll see. So this is one of them, because the depth of instruction and understanding that's in Srila Prabhupada won't really be revealed to us until we take it seriously. And I think on this matter, the governing body of ISKCON has become pretty convinced. We've discussed this several times, and now almost everyone on the GBC sees this as a future of ISKCON, that it becomes educational institution. What does it mean? Well, I would say it would mean, like, for example, somebody wants to come and live in the temple, join a bhakta or bhakti program. That should just be like enrolling in school. You should have a curriculum. Half the day's classes, other half of the day things like, sankirtan and practical things like that. And there's a course of study, the classes you have to take when you get bhakti shastri, then you can be initiated or something like that. You can work it out so that everywhere the temples are like that, they run just like divinity schools for training of people. Some people may stay for a long time in the temples and continue that function, but many other people, maybe most people, will come stay in the temples a while, learn Krishna consciousness, become initiated devotees, and then move out in some other capacity. But that should be our primary aim. The temple should also, their function to the rest of society, to congregation, for example, to their own children going up through the age brackets, to the adults who continue in Krishna consciousness, should all be to provide constant continuing education. From age, you know, from kindergarten up to graduate school and beyond, and also laterally throughout all different sectors of society. And this is what we're at Abhintur, when we had that conference, this is what we elaborated on. And so I think that's something that's happening. And so in this way, we'll become more and more of a Brahminical society, at least a section of it. So that's one thing I think that really has to happen next, and is in the process of happening that way. We've also, when I was a devotee in academics, I was practically the only one. Now there are many, many other devotees getting into academics. This is, I think, something also. Prabhupada wrote in one letter that there are so many departments of religion, I want that our men should head them up. It's not that academic life is for everybody, but there's a level of society, of karmi society, in which we are not yet able to engage in discourse with in a way that will be respected. By people going to graduate school and things like that, they're learning how to engage in that kind of discourse. And this is and when we do so, people are rather startled about Krishna consciousness. And so they can begin to start to see what we have. Theologians who have listened to devotees, see, they won't listen to some guy in the street with a book. I mean, they're snobs. And in order for them to listen to you, sometimes you have to be able to use the kind of language and have the same body of references and that they have. Then they'll listen. That's why I said a PhD is really initiation into you're one of us. We'll listen to you. And then when they listen to Krishna consciousness, it's quite a revelation to many of them. And sooner or later, on the deepest intellectual level, devotees have to confront the whole challenge of modernism and modernity. In some ways, Krishna consciousness is a healthy living religious tradition because it avoided certain things that the religions of the West have gone through. It didn't undergo Renaissance, didn't undergo Enlightenment, didn't undergo Industrial Revolution, and so it kind of remains whole. But now there's no way you're going to avoid confronting these things, and so that's a challenge. Another thing is that I think that we have to start doing right now is a kind of understanding of what it means to have family life and to really establish family life. This is part of what you have to do in the matter of taking care of children. We're already talking about the difficulties we had in Gurukula and neglect of children, abuse of children, but often the way in the past in ISKCON family life has been done has been in the same way. There has to be a kind of family reform that needs to take place that we can begin right now. Because if you see what Prabhupada talks about family life and the where he says what differentiates Varnashram Dharma from ordinary human society is Garbha Dhana Samskara. And the whole purpose of Varnashram Dharma is to produce high-grade offspring. And that's what the family life is for. We discussed yesterday about the decay of family life and the toll it does, it takes on people. So, in family life, it has to be done so that there's Garbha Dhana Samskara. That's where the protection of children begins, actually, right at conception. It goes on during the period of pregnancy, and in the family especially, it has to become the focus until a child is five, especially. And I would say that in order to have this commitment, whatever occupational engagements women may have in this movement, that if they're going to have children, there has to be a certain time set aside where that is the major concern, and that the children are given this constant affection that Prabhupada, if the mother's not available to do herself, somebody has to be there, some group of people who give the children constant affection, especially spoiling them, as Prabhupada says, they need to be spoiled until the age of five. Then things can be a little more, can be more disciplined, but that's necessary for well-being. And so any social system which doesn't allow for this is a big mistake. And that should be seen as one of the most important of engagements. It shouldn't be seen that, oh, we have preaching work to do, we have DD work to do, we have to do all these other things. And by the way, when you got a little time and despair, take care of your children. It can't be like that. Just as we understand the Gurukulas need to have far more importance, so does the raising of children and families need to have far more importance. We should learn etiquette. And Vedic etiquette and the kind of training for this hierarchical society actually has to begin in the family. So the traditional way it's done in India is when a child gets up, the first thing the child does when he gets up in the morning is goes to his or her mother and offers obeisances, touching her feet. That's because the mother is the first guru. Then the child goes to the father and offers obeisances to the father. I wasn't raised that way. And some of us might find it a little hard to but that is the genuine Vedic way. We had a whole class about this from, who was it, Krishnadas Swami, came around and talked about this. And if you go to India, that's what it's done. Because, see, the mother and the father represent God. And they're natural representatives of God. I mean, here's a child who's small, helpless, and dependent. So this is the dependent condition, in childhood, the dependent condition of the jiva is most clearly manifest. And so that's why the father and mother come to represent for the child's idea of God. When fathers and mothers are bad, how are you going to teach them later on, that God is our father who cares for us, when their ideas of fathers or mothers are bleh, So this is where atheism begins. It begins in the cradle, when parents don't actually represent God. Everyone who is a position of authority over others has to represent God. So the place for this really to begin is, so the meaning is you have to not just, people have to say, yes, this person represents God, but you have to actually represent God. That's the burden, that's the responsibility, that's the obligation. If you're going to be a father, if you're going to be a mother, if you're going to be a teacher, if you're going to be a leader of any kind, have any dependence anywhere, you have to be a representative of God. Another thing, of course, that's very important is we have to learn relationships of commitment. I mean, and again, when the idea of divorce should just not even be in our minds as a possibility. It shouldn't even be something we should think about. It should be just out of the question. It should be just like eating meat. It's just something that we, we may be in a lot of problems, but that is something that, is the pits. This business of getting married and getting divorced and getting married and getting divorced is, everybody thought it was great fun in the 60s, creative divorce, I can grow as a person, I'm not the same person I was when I made these relations. It's fine, we can have a great time. Oh, by the way, what does it do to the children? Oh yeah, what about them? People need a certain basic security in life, which comes from childhood, and that security is based on certain things being stable, and that's family life. So I would say that's another way, a place to really begin. Certain elements of Varnashram Dharma and hierarchical ideas is right in the relationship within the family. Another thing that's very important that Prabhupada stressed very much is the agrarian economy. He did want us to have farm communities. When he wanted to go to Gita Nagari in the end, he said, I will teach you Varnashram Dharma, I shall teach you how to live off the land. So Prabhupada recognized this importance of the agrarian economy to Varnashram Dharma. Now we're in the middle of a whole industrial economy, and we can maybe have our little farm communities that'll be something, but the point of at least having these farm communities is we should learn how to do it. And in this matter, I think that it's important to recognize that as far as the industrial civilization, the latest thing, which has only happened in the last 50 years, this is how brand new it is, but has been going on at an incredible pace, is the industrialization of agriculture. Before World War II, although there were tractors around, actually there were still a great number of farm animals, even in a country like the United States, even though there were tractors. It had already begun with tractors and combines and things like that. But still, most of the population before World War II in the United States and probably the rest of the developed world, most of the people still lived on farms. And the farms were small family farms. Since World War II, the family farms have disappeared. Now you see farms in the United States, 50,000 acres, huge things, and owned by a big company. A big Archer Daniels Middling and all these other big agribusinesses. And so the means of industrial production being applied very thoroughly to agriculture is a very new experiment. And what this has done what does it mean? Well, it means that first of all, the people that work the land are simply hired hands of the company. The company is being run by people in skyscrapers in New York and places like that. There's no relationship with the land. And the land is made to produce lavishly by artificial means. Artificial fertilizer, artificial pest control, huge machineries. A little tractor is harmless compared. You see these farm machines now being used in agribusiness. The thing looks like a skyscraper. The operator is six stories above the land, rolling along in some gigantic piece of machinery that's, got this huge thing churning, plowing or harvesting or something like. You're in an air conditioned cab with quadraphonic sound blaring rock and roll. You don't get your hands dirty. All you do is run machinery. These kind of, they call them factory farms. What they do to animals is beyond belief. Some of that's the scandal of it is just becoming a little more apparent with mad cow disease. People, they're feeding, you know, animals, the cows back to cows again, and so on like that. It's just it's horrible. It all depends upon mechanical means. It all depends on heavy machinery. It depends upon artificial fertilizer, which is a petroleum product. It depends upon what this does to the land. You know, basically what you do is it destroys the land very quickly. Artificial fertilizer, artificial irrigation also. The deep plowing means that, you know, huge amounts of topsoil blows away. And in effect, what you are doing is living on your capital. Right now, you'll get huge production out of the land, but after a while, it's going to fail. The food supply of the world is concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. It's not distributed now. So there will be very, very few businesses. There are businesses that own businesses, and businesses that own businesses that own businesses, and there's an increasing concentration at the top. So that becomes extremely vulnerable to various fluctuations in the economic market. So also another thing that's going on is, genetic engineering. The same agribusiness are the ones that are doing genetic engineering and introducing flounder genes inside of tomatoes and all kinds of other things. Nobody knows what the result of that will be, but it's getting more and more artificial and dependent upon being able to sustain a certain level of technical conditions. The same companies that are in charge of the production are also more and more in charge of food distribution. Distribution is very artificial. People don't usually eat what is locally grown. It comes from far away. And what's locally grown gets less and less and less because the local growers can't compete with the big farmers. So my prediction is that if the industrial civilization starts to collapse, this will probably be the area. And all of a sudden there will not be food. And that's what's going to really set off a lot of social turmoil. There simply will not be food, or people will find out what they're eating, or other human beings, you know, reprocessed or something like that. They're doing it to cows, you know, just given time. I think these farm communities are very, very important, that people have to learn the skills of living off the land, even though right now it may be just a specialized few. When the time comes, people are going to need them. The other suggestion I have is, if we have money, buy land. Even if we can't do much with it now, have it. Have arable land, good agricultural producing land. If you're householders and you've got some surplus, buy land. The more land that's in the hands of devotees, that can be, even if it's small plots, amazing what you can get out of a few hectares if you know what you're doing. But buy land and just have it available, even if you can't do that much with it. That's my suggestion. Also, you might want to say, if we're looking for land, get a piece of land that's got a stream or river on it with a sufficient fall that you can have a mill. I'm sure there exist maps in archaeological surveys that before the Industrial Revolution where the water mills were. Find it, just like in Abentoy, there's Satchinandana Swami lives in a water mill. And you can see that at one point there was a mill pond, and there was the race where the water was funneled, and there was a wheel. If you can get one, hang on to it. And if you need to get the legal rights to run it, because if there's a source of power that's can do a lot. So I would just as a personal suggestion, if you have an opportunity to buy land, look for with a stream that has a sufficient fall on it that you can make a mill. And usually you'll find if it's that way somewhere, 200 years ago there was a mill there. I saw a map of England where all the mills were drawn in the rivers, and it was amazing. You know, back in the 16th century, amazing what was going on. So that's the other thing, that to prepare for this thing is that we do need to have our self-sufficient communities, even if they remain small, and even if a large part of our devotees don't live in them, and they're still going to be preaching outside, and that we buy land. As far as economics, for what we learn from Varnashram Dharma, as far as householders getting into business, people having to make money, with some kind of money making enterprise, the businesses, the people who are doing business, vaishyas, or somebody else is doing it as an emergency measure, they should be independent. We should look to the model of the family business, which is a personally owned enterprise. It would be better to have that kind of business set up in such a way that even if you have a big thing, it's better to have all the people and the parts be independent people who have some kind of union together, rather than something that's owned by somebody and everybody else's employees. If you want to have vaishyas, they should be independent, those who are vaishyas. So we should look to set up businesses that have lots of independent people. And I would also suggest that as far as possible, businesses should also be family-centered. It is very, very good, and this is also the system you see in India, that if you have a family business, it's something that the children can participate in even as their children. They can learn how to do it. This is also an agrarian society, that where you live and where you work, say you have some enterprise, whatever it may be, where you live and where you work is not more than 10 steps away. And that means that whole enterprise is something the entire family can, the children, they can assist in some way or another, learn how to do it, and naturally become apprenticed by the father. So this is that cottage industry model that Prabhupada liked, and which he took from Gandhi. You go to Indian villages, you're still, they may be weaving, but it's right there, the hand loom is there. These little kids do it sometimes. This also. And that also strengthens the family very, very much. That the family, the children are engaged in devotional activities, and practical activities which are done for the sake of Krishna, together with the parents. They learn so many principles of Krishna consciousness are learned that way. So this is another suggestion I have. It may be we talked about the village as a kind of a model for the way to live. Well, we don't live in villages anymore, and here we are from all over the world together. Thinking about is there any possibility of having what one person described in another context as a global village? This was thought we'd all be united together by technology and by the internet, and we'd have a television or whatever, and we have a global village. He was thinking of this for humanity at large, and it doesn't seem to be happening. Or if it is, you don't want to be part of it. But I wonder about ISKCON as at least for now a kind of a global village, in the sense that we might be spread all over the place. You might not be living in one place, but we have a sufficiently dense culture that we can relate to each other the way people in villages relate to each other. having unplugged ourselves sufficiently from the conditions of an industrial civilization. This means that to me, at least, as I said, the cement of this kind of relationship is the ability to fulfill obligations. That's what holds it together. When we understand the importance of obligations and the consciousness of obligations much more than any consciousness of rights. I mentioned it before, the whole system is based on obligations. By the way, this is point, I have to give credit where credit is due. Although this is in our scripture, I didn't notice until it was pointed out by Simone Weil. Simone Weil is a French theologian. She's only about, lived to 33 years old. She wrote this book near the end of World War II, The Need for Roots. And she begins she calls it a prelude to a declaration of duties toward mankind. And she begins by saying, the notion of obligations comes before that of rights. It's called the needs of the soul, which is subordinate and relative to the former. And she talks about the importance of obligations. And that's when from reading this, I suddenly realized, yeah, this is really a key to understanding ISKCON. Several times in the GBC, we've talked about a constitution for ISKCONs, and people keep talking about a bill of rights. And that always seemed weird, you know, coming from America, everybody wants rights. Bill of rights, the constitution. But actually, what it should be is, for every role in ISKCON, there should be a list of obligations. And those obligations should have a huge amount of force. Like, for example, and people should be held to their obligations. There should be a great deal of taking them seriously. When I was became a temple president, I wrote Prabhupada, and I was a new devotee. I mean, I had been initiated a few months, and this is the way we did things in those days. Anyway, I wrote Prabhupada a letter asking him, now I'm a temple president, well, what should I do? What are my duties? And he gave me a list, sent back a list, and had to make sure books are being distributed as many as possible, the deity worship is going on nicely. But the first thing on the list was make sure that all the devotees in the temple are happy. And, you know, I thought, well, you know. but more and more as time goes on, you know, that was the first thing on the list, because actually that was the first priority. As a temple president, that was my obligation to each devotee. Are you happy? If you're not happy, why not? Now, it may not be anybody's fault but that devotee's. That's still my obligation. See, what is the matter? That can I help you in some way that you aren't happy? Well, if they're not happy because of real circumstances, then that's my obligation to straighten out the circumstances so that they can be happy. But no, and somehow or other, they have to be happy. And if somebody is unhappy, I'm not doing my job right. And then later on, you know, Prabhupada mentions also about kshatriyas. Their job is to see that everyone in the kingdom is happy. And so these kind of obligations have to be taken very, very seriously. And one has to go through and see what every role we have in ISKCON, things like, you know, GBC, sannyasi, temple president, father, mother, all these things, each of them have their obligations. And those obligations all have to be listed and taken seriously. This is part of something that's very, very important in Vedic culture, and which is hard for us to understand, which is, of course, the importance of keeping vows. This has been the singular failure of ISKCON, that we make vows and we don't keep them. We take initiation vows and we don't keep them. We take marriage vows, we don't keep them. We make promises of all kinds of others, and then we feel free to break them whenever we feel like them. This shows that there's a social breakdown when this happens. People should be able to make, in Vedic culture, to tell a lie and to break a promise are on the exact same level. If you break a promise, if you take a vow and you don't keep it, it's considered untruthful. just as much as telling a deliberate lie is untruthful. And so this, in keeping vows and fulfilling obligations are the same thing. So if that is instituted, that we can trust people to fulfill their obligations, and the people who have obligations are trustworthy enough to execute them, then I think ISKCON itself will become more and more like a village. And where a devotee is instantly someone you can trust and have confidence in and faith in, and of course, I mean, when we say, just like Krishna says, surrender to me, and then he says, I'll give you all protection. I mean, those two go together. You surrender to Krishna, and Krishna says, if you think I'm going to surrender to Krishna, but he can't protect me, then I better do make another arrangement also. It's the same thing when as devotees, people surrender us, even our capacity of any kind of leader. People are surrendering to us. We have to be able to give them protection. Otherwise, they'll say, well, I surrendered, but it was a big mistake. So that's the biggest obligation. Another thing is, we talked about brahmas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas, but there's something we haven't mentioned very much, and that's shudras. I want to point out that we all have a shudra name. Das, Dasi are the names of shudras. It means I'm Krishna shudra, but then that means I'm also the shudra of every devotee. It will have to be the case that also, as I said, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, the distinguishing characteristic is capable of independent action. If somebody starts a business and it fails, and again starts a business and it fails, and again starts a business and it fails, and has like a continuous history of very bad business judgment, then we have to say that person is not a Vaishya. That person better work for somebody who's got good judgment, and so on. So that's where you get this category of shudra. Prabhupada calls shudras general assistants. But one cannot have these general assistants in our movement. They're all Vaishnavas, and they should be treated as such. Again, it's very old-fashioned, but you see, in the olden days where there were family servants or retainers, there was an obligation to take care of these people, even in their old age, even when they couldn't work. That was the bound there with the family. Even sometimes, different generations, one after another, they were with families, and there was a certain security there. And also, I've seen this in India where a devotee family, they had some family member, Indian devotee family, initiated devotees, and also their family servant became an initiated devotee. And although one was the servant, that servant was such a good devotee, that servant was treated just like a great devotee, even though there was a servant. And people were extremely respectful and understood that, you know, the same way, I cannot mistreat this person. So the mistreatment of anybody who's lower is the cause of all difficulties and problems with this system. So anyway, those are some of the practical suggestions that I have of how to get to this point from where we are now. I understand that when this system has a downside, that is when it doesn't work, we know what the difficulties are. And there's no guarantee in the system itself that it's going to work perfectly. No system is foolproof. This system works when you actually have Brahmanas being Brahmanas, when you have a Confucian rectification of names. Nevertheless, this is Krishna's system. Everything that we put in place by our own concoction turns out to be much worse. Every time we try to fix it, we make it worse. And we try to fix that and it gets worse yet, and we try to fix that and it gets worse yet. But we also should understand when things go wrong, why they go wrong, and how they should be corrected. And the main thing, of course, we have to avoid is a fragmental part of a hierarchical system. It has to be a complete whole. People have been taking the Isha Upanishad course. You have Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. They're part of the complete whole. And when everything is working together, each part becomes complete in itself. And that's the vision that we are looking for in this. So now that's what I have to say about where do we go from here, the steps. So now we can go on to any other ideas or questions or go on. Yes.
First of all, it was wonderful to give this vision and to hear especially about family life. It's really touching the heart for people who live 10 or 20 years under the pressure of culture and situation.
Yeah.
But still, I see a problem, or I have a question. What to do with this 80 or 90% of the people who can't follow vows, keep vows, who can't live in a marriage with hell and think, oh, divorce is not possible. Mm-hmm. How to take away this pressure to make them even more sick? How to give them possibility to live in the community, to, you know what I mean? Don't you say you have to love your children with protection? We are all sick people, abused people in one or another way. We don't even know what is affection.
Mm-hmm.
Some mothers love their children to death.
Mm-hmm.
So what to do?
Yeah. Well, in the short run, I guess we're just going to have to do the best we can. I don't think this system is something we have to work toward, and we have to deal with people the way they are now. And you're not going to be able to take somebody and do a complete psychological makeover instantly. We should know what direction we're headed in, and it will take a number of generations, I think, if each generation has a little improvement to get better like that. Otherwise, we just try to give people as much Krishna consciousness as possible. In the Varnashram system, it's very clear in the seventh. I'll get this out. You look at the seventh canto. It talks about people who can't live in the system, and there's places outside the system for them, that will happen. I mean, Prabhupada mentions Aboriginal people; those are outside the system, and I could imagine the future where, like, you had a wide area of land in which there are Krishna conscious communities and people are following Varnashram Dharma. You might get Aborigines coming back again. Now, maybe the original ones over here are gone, but some hippie tribe might go to live in the forest and dress in animal skins. I think some groups may be headed that way already. There's a place for them outside the system. In the seventh canto, it talks about these different sorts, and that's where it makes the statement get past the Sri Dharma here. It talks about thieves, for example, and they also have their hereditary customs. There's a culture of thieves. And it also mentions what are these people who can't follow this system. That's where it says, if an agricultural field is cultivated again and again, the power of its production decreases, and whatever seeds are sown there are lost. Just as drops of ghee on a fire will never extinguish the fire, but a flood of ghee will, similarly, overindulgence in lusty desires mitigates such desires entirely. What to do with people that can't follow any principles? Well, let them have their own place. Stand back. those people can enjoy sinful activities all they like. No problem, because you have a different standard from us. You know, for you, this is your standard. So there's even a relativity built into the system. But you follow your own standard. And there's honor among thieves. You follow your own standard and indulge in these desires. And then the hope is that, one day they'll get the chance that these activities will become detestable to them and they'll get the opportunity to become purified. So actually the system recommends that for some people there's going to be too much pressure to follow the system, even with the allowances of the different ashrams and the different varnas. So there's this place for you too. So we can take some place like New York City or and set it aside. Well, the gentleman will live in Philadelphia, right?
Which chapter is
this? This is Canto 7, Chapter 11. They also said, Narada Muni says, if one shows the symptoms of being a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, even if he appears in a different class, he should be accepting according to those symptoms of classification. By the way, that verse is in here. Okay? Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned that divorce is not an option and that children need stability and security. I think that's very important, and I think it's regrettable that many people take their marriage vows too lightly. But at the same time, I think we also need to recognize that there are times when divorce is not only an option but also the healthiest thing, both for the wife and for the children. And that's in the case of abuse, which can be extremely harmful for the children and for the wife, obviously.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I would just hate for women to think that they were somehow being invaded by putting up
with it.
I think that but before you divorce, every other step must be taken to end that relationship, to end those activities in that relationship, rather. Yeah?
Prabhupada was in favor of separation.
Yeah, Prabhupada was in favor in that case of separation. He was not in favor of... It's not actually divorce that's, in a sense, outlawed. What it is remarriage, which Prabhupada was very strong about. And that's something to think about, anyway. Because not having remarriage also can present ways to deal with that, but that's what he said. But yeah, definitely separation in that case he definitely allowed for. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, don't put up, that's right. I mean, the whole thing is that there should not be in this thing anywhere abuse of power. And if the system is going to work, the abuse of power has to be corrected and mitigated. On every possible level. I have some questions here. Yeah.
If I would try to distill one underlying principle of Varnashram, what comes to mind after your presentation is the natural hierarchical order of things, which mm-hmm. is there by nature. Could you, because it seems to be, am I correct? This is very important.
Yes. Yeah.
Why did Krishna make the world like this? And because free-floating competition place where the where according to what appears, someone takes on a position. In other words. Why did he make it that the women are inferior to men
in the hierarchy,
in the hierarchical mm-hmm. order? And why not just look now, why not mix it up according to qualifications which arise naturally?
Well, the qualifications do arise naturally. That's the whole point of it. I mean, if Krishna made it, that means what's natural means what Krishna has made. Could he have made it differently? Well, I don't know. He's God, but I once asked Prabhupada, you know, why does Krishna need demigods to run the universe? You know, he's all powerful. Prabhupada said to me, you don't know how to run a universe. I said, that's true, I don't, you know. So, I mean, in one sense, I have to defer to Krishna's judgment in this matter. Why he did it this particular way? And sometimes we think if I was God, I could do it better. But that's probably a mistake. Big mistake. But let me say that there are different levels in this universe for the accommodation of the different desires of living entities. And what the Varnashram Dharma system does is accommodate those desires and regulate them in a certain way so that everybody can make spiritual advancement. If you don't have this system, there's still going to be better or worse, controller and controlled, power, weakness. These things are going to be there. But what will happen will be disorder, and it will not be conducive to people's spiritual development. So it seems to me that's what the system, it takes advantage of these goodness, passion, and ignorance, and orders them in a certain way so that everybody can make spiritual advancement. When the mode of ignorance is in control, as sometimes can happen, then there will not be any, or even the mode of passion is, there's spiritual advancement. The whole purpose of human life becomes blocked. And we don't make spiritual advancement. And what's the use of the world? Yeah?
Well, I think there's a big misunderstanding in this relationship, men and women. Men are superior and women are subordinate. It's something in marriage. You can't say that generally. You can maybe take the most intelligent, dominical woman of the world in relationship to the most greatest.
Yeah, sure.
A man in the world, and that the man is superior to these women. Mm-hmm. This is complete nonsense.
No, that's not what he's talking about.
No, but usually it is always talking
yeah.
Like that.
Well, what it means is that in the natural order of things, this is the order. But somebody in their own order, huh? What? I was looking. I always think it says Brahman Kachya Vaishya. To my mind, you know. But there is a natural order. One thing is, of course, is women of the same quality should be married to men of the same quality. When Prabhupada was in the Philadelphia airport, my daughter, how old was she then? Like 8 years old. So she had all these bangles on. I mean, just rows and rows. Every time she moved her arm, shrunk. So we were just sitting there, and Prabhupada was watching her, and he said, oh, they like those here too, meaning girls in the West, they like this bangle system. And he was watching the bangles, and he looks at me and he says, better marry her to a Kshatriya. And then one of the GBC, she in Gurukula, she was very, very, their best Sanskrit student, so the GBC asked her to recite some verse in Bhagavad Gita, you know, and gave her the number, and she just rattled the verse off. Prabhupada says, oh, better make it a Brahmana. So it's important that otherwise you get very, very disturbed conditions. And that's one reason marriage is very difficult. Nobody knows how to match people up anymore in this matter. We have a few more minutes, and I got a whole bunch of questions about the woman's thing. From yesterday's class, and maybe I could give some a few. Will woman's activities be reduced to just give birth and raising children? That is to say, if we put this emphasis on the importance of motherhood and being a specialist in that activity, I don't think that's the only activity women will do. And what women will do and what they'll be trained to do, that also depends upon Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, where they fit in that scheme of thing, the degree of education and training and something like that. I would say this, will their education again be reduced to household? What's that German, Kirscher, Kinder, Kirscher? That's what you're afraid of, huh? going to be Germany in the 30s. That's what, in America, they're all afraid of America in the 50s, you know. it would seem to me that what it is not so much that it's limited to these things, but whatever women do, it shouldn't be to make them incapacitated for that activity. That's at least my instruction. And it's not that every woman is necessarily going to be a mother if, you know, they don't have that maternal instinct, don't want to have kids. Well, okay, but listen, people should be engaged in Krishna service one way or another. I'm not in favor of cramming people into boxes they don't fit in. But this is what's said is natural, and over the course of the time, if you go with what's natural will develop more and more and more. We read that women in Vedic culture were trained in the 64 arts. I mean, that's metallurgy. I mean, you read that list of 64 arts, that's a better education than almost anybody gets today. So there's very, very high culture. I think women should be educated to their capacity. As far as being intelligent, when the intelligence is there, that intelligence has to be engaged and cultivated. You know, I read, and I think I read with profit, this book by essay by Virginia Woolf called A Room of One's Own. I can understand that, you know, that where were the female Shakespeares who could never express themselves because they didn't have a few simple things, a room of their own, and 50 guineas a year, a small income. So one can appreciate that point, that people have talents and abilities. They should be engaged in Krishna service. If a woman is good at literature and art, that should be engaged. And remember, there should be help with the child rearing. One thing about the system is if you have people who are general assistants, that will help. And one needn't be, you know, I mean, what it is like all day long, you think of a woman taking care of a child, you think of a practically empty apartment, nobody around, one woman, one child facing each other 18 hours a day. That would drive anybody nuts, and in fact it does. But here we're trying to think more toward an extended family. There will be relatives, there will be grandparents, there will be serving people, you know, things will be social. And raising the children will be not just fall upon one person left alone with nothing but the television set to keep them company. This is not what we're looking for. How can men what does it mean to protect women? Well, I know. I think it means that, among other things, that women who are protected live in something of a sheltered environment. That certain things men should take care of in the more rough, hurly burly things of the world, so that women can like a hothouse plant or something, they can really develop feminine qualities. That doesn't mean that I think that women are incapable of dealing with themselves in the world. I think many women quite are, and do as well as the men. But then it has the capacity of, in fact, turning women into men. I saw on television. A woman who was one of the first fighter pilots in the United States Navy, and in fact there was a scandal where the male pilots kind of went crazy and had this party, and they abused, molested a lot of women, the tailhook scandal, and this woman pilot was one of them. So she was being interviewed on television, and she says, "If those sons of bitches can think they can do like me, though, you got to know, you know." I mean, she was a guy. I mean, she was as tough and as macho as any of these guys, you know. I'm sure it can be done. I mean, there's no problem. But if what I say about specialization is true, maybe that's not, you know, why do that with women when you can mince can specialize in that activity. That's what it does, and that's why one part of what it means to protect women. I hope it doesn't mean to oppress women. Again, anybody can take any advantage of any power relationship, and that's why there have to be safeguards. And the biggest safeguard is a good education from the beginning by the brahmanas. How can men overcome their obviously very deep-rooted, also in spiritual communities, tendency to exploit, especially if they are encouraged in their false ego as a Purusha? Again, you may think it's an impossible project. But exploiting material nature should really not be... that's our whole thing we're learning, trying to learn not to do. Vedic culture is quite different. We're all supposed to learn, as far as the Purusha goes, that's Krishna, and everyone else is Prakriti. You may think, well, the Krishna consciousness has been going on for so long and people haven't learned it yet. That's just the bad material we're working with to begin with, is part of the problem. Anyway, I'm not giving up on it. Would women again have to stand in the back, forbidden to give classes? I don't see why that should be a... Would there be female gurus? Well, there have been female gurus. On the other side of this Varnashram thing, everyone is a Vaishnava. If somebody can give spiritual knowledge, they should give it. As far as where they stand, it is the obligation of our society to see that women have every opportunity for spiritual advancement. And if anything is done that doesn't give that woman opportunity for spiritual advancement, then we failed. And if that means standing in this place as opposed to that place, I think it should be facilitated, whatever it takes. Yeah.
I was thinking back to this article of C.S. Lewis. He talks a little bit about abusive power in the sense, like, in other words, like, there's certain people that you may have authority over, but also there's people that you don't have authority over, say your equals, or you may have authority over your wife, but it doesn't mean you have authority over everybody else's wife or children or whatever. So it seems that it's important. It's sort of like etiquette. If we learn people have authorities, and then people have others that aren't. So I think some of the problems were
just
the wrong people. Yeah. Somebody is bossy to whoever they can lord it over,
sure.
Whether it was their position or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like a system, and it'll become more clear where it's all unorganized, and basically you're tough guy wins, and watch out. Being a woman is just one excuse for lording over someone's a man. I can figure out another reason why I'm superior to him, too. I certainly don't think abuse of power has just been accepted.
All over the place.
Yeah, and our whole movement, mm-hmm. not knowing who has authority over who and who doesn't. The opposite.
It's now 10 hours. The next class ready for the next class. Is that right? We said we had an hour and 20 minutes. When does the next class begin? Five more minutes?
No,
10. 10 more minutes? Oh, okay. One more question on this list here. What do you think of the concept that every person has male and female qualities and that they both need to be developed and well-balanced in order to become a mature person and have mature relationships? Well, we're into that in America. The men get together and they cry. It's true what this statement is. People do have male side and female side, and every man there's a woman trying to get out, and in every woman there's a man trying to get out. And the balance is different for different people. And I don't think by saying that men should specialize in being men and women should specialize in being women, that necessarily means that you're going to deny all of the opposite things that'll be there. You know, because people who don't, you know, men who have no sensitivity, if the sensitivity is a female quality, you know, they become a little monstrous and so on. So let's take people as they come and engage ourselves in Krishna service whatever talents, propensities, abilities we have, let's just use them in Krishna service. If today we're more androgynous than we used to be, and it's better to have more specialization, we'll get there. But meanwhile, we are what we are, and I'm not going to tell anyone who has now been trained and knows how to you know, a woman who knows how to command a tank division, not to use those talents in Krishna service if possible. You got them, go ahead and use them. That's all right. There is a fact that men do tend to have the preponderance of masculine qualities by nature and women feminine qualities by nature, and that should really be developed in a proper way. But it doesn't mean to denial that any other side in men, any softness or tenderness and so on like that can't be expressed and all those other things. And that can certainly lead to difficulties. So are there other questions or comments? Yeah.
So you're speaking about the procreation and child raising is very fundamental in creating a good population.
Yeah.
And and we know that's a problem in ISKCON, that this isn't following a problem. So I'd like to know if anything is being done in the distribution of that knowledge, because that knowledge has already been researched as to the samskaras in the household life, since it is so foundational. If anything is being done to distribute that knowledge to the Grihastha community.
That's good. I don't know if anything's going on in any systematic way. But it is important. That's a good point. We should have a journal of householder life or something, and lay these things out, or at least a web page or a conference or something where that can be talked about. If that's not generally known or not generally followed, I agree with that. Yeah.
I think that might be a part of the problem.
Yeah.
That information.
Yeah.
Benefits of doing this.
Sure. Yeah.
There are some compilations available now. One done by Jaladas, also one done by Jaishila.
Mm-hmm.
So it's available.
Yeah, that's true. Jaishila is working on this. That I know right now. That's true. I'm all past my child producing years, I guess. A more theoretical level at this point, but maybe not in touch with the more practical side of these things, but it is important. Anyone else? Yes.
In the matter of finding our varna and where we're properly situated, my thought came to me that I'm at our farm in Sweden, base. And because everyone there want to be the best, now the tendency is we all want to be best.
Yeah.
So that's our conditioning. But then actually, what I thought was a lack of feeling of security. You want to be the best because then you feel secure. But if there actually was security, a different kind of social security, not in the sense of economical.
Yeah.
But then actually people would be more able to admit to themselves
whether they're fit. Yeah, that's a good point. One thing I've noticed about people who want to be at the top of whatever hierarchy is around, it's not even so much that they want to lord it over others. They just don't trust anybody to tell them what to do. They're not so interested in telling other people. They don't want anybody to tell them what to do because of this mistrust of authority. And not having experienced the benefits of having genuine shelter. This aspect of giving shelter, and this is what it means to protect. Prabhupada gave a definition of management once. He says, to manage means to care for. So in giving shelter, one has to experience the benefits of being cared for by whoever it is who knows how, who's in that position to do so, whether it's within a family relationship, within the structure of ISKCON, between the relationship between spiritual master and disciple. One begins to experience. So in order to experience those, people actually know how to take care of other people and actually care for people. Manage means to care for. Take care of, and also to actually have real feeling for people and be concerned and committed to their well-being. And if that happens, then people will naturally be more willing to take their position. They'll be more advantageous to be in a position with somebody that cares for me than to think that, you know, I don't want anybody to care for me. Thanks, I've had it with that kind of care. So that's been our problem, and it's something we have to get over. Yes, last one, I think, yeah.
Well, yeah. You presented the future, but you suggest for the future the achieve an astronomical system in a society. How does it fit with the preacher vision we would like to achieve as that?
Well, part of what we have to preach is Varnashram Dharma. That's one thing. I believe myself that the more our society starts to follow these principles, as I've outlined it, the more naturally attractive it will be to other people. The preaching means two things. You have to convince people to become devotees, and then you have to give them a situation in which their devotional activities can best develop. And according to Prabhupada, this is really the best situation. In one sense, it's a little difficult because if we're thinking that Varnashram Dharma means being in a rural situation and preaching is generally an urban situation, how are we going to go back and forth or whatever? And that does make a little nervousness. In America, we have this Amish community, who basically are isolated. They live on farms. They come from Germany. They're like, and they try to live just like, 18th century German farmers. Basically, they don't have any machinery, anything like that, and they stay pure by not making devotees, or recruiting. The only way you can become an Amish is by being born into it. We once had they're all around our area and Gita Nagari farm. They shear our sheep, and as Amish women that the ladies go to for a midwife. So we have some interaction with them. And one devotee left the movement, and he decided he wanted to become Amish. He put on his clothes and grew a beard. They didn't. It was just a joke, you know. You can't do it. You can't join. And the other way they remain pure is if anybody deviates, he's banished, just out of the community, never to be seen again. You know, just gone. Wife doesn't talk to you. Husband doesn't talk to you. Nobody, you know, they don't know you anymore. They pass you on the streets. They don't see you. That's how they stay pure. We're not going to have the banishment, nor do we have we preach. And yet we also want to have this very pure society. So I think that's a big demand on us. And it's one that we have to, you know, rise to. That's all I can say. And now we've come past our time, right, Brindisenheim? We have. And I want to thank all of you for being such a good class. And it's helped me a lot to have you here to help me think these things through more, and by your attention and also by your good questions. So I want to thank you, and please accept my basis.
about that rule?